Welcome to Copper Country Today, here Sunday mornings at 7 o'clock on 97.7 The Wolf, 8 o'clock on 1400 AM, 99.3 FM WCCY, and 9 o'clock on KBear 102.3. Our program is brought to you in part by the members of the Copper Country Education Association and by the Copper Country Veterinary Clinic, proud supporters of the Copper Country Humane Society and the Keweenaw Spay and Neuter Assistance Group. You can also listen to a podcast of our program by going to the Copper Country Today page at KeweenawReport.com. Special thanks to Kevin Haryu from the Houghton County Road Commission, who joined me in the first segment to talk about the status of the local roads. But for now, I'm joined in studio by Lindsay Hiltonen from the Michigan Tech Archives. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yep, thanks for having me.
You're relatively new to the senior archivist position, but you've been with Tech for a while now. Give us a little background about yourself.
Sure. I'm actually a native Youper. I grew up in the Copper Country. I'm originally from Tamarack City, went to Dollar Bay Schools, and I'm also an alum of Michigan Tech. I graduated in 2003. I have two master's degrees, one in library and information science and one in U.S. history. And once I finished my education, my husband and I knew that we wanted to come back to the Copper Country because both of our families are there. I was fortunate to make connections at Michigan Tech and get a foot in the door into the archives. I interned there last summer, and they brought me back this summer to do some cataloging work, and it's sort of turning into a position now.
Give us a little bit of background, because the history of the Copper Country goes back a while back, but collecting and archiving all of this stuff. When did that start at Michigan Tech?
Sure. The archives didn't become a formal program at Michigan Tech until the later 20th century. But when the school was first starting, the A.E. Seaman, he was a professor of geology and mineralogy at Michigan Tech, and he started collecting journals related to geology, engineering, mining science, things like this. Mm-hmm. And slowly, they started to collect more materials that had a historic nature. In the 1930s, they recognized that they wanted to have an archives program or separate out historical titles, but they didn't necessarily have the space to do that.
Oh, yeah.
In 1966, when the library building was finished, they went ahead and actually dedicated archive space up on the third floor, and that's when they formally started to actively collect a lot of historic documents. They hired their first professionally trained archivist, I believe, in 1978. That was Teresa Spence, and she helped formalize the archives program at Michigan Tech. We moved into our new location in the garden level of the Van Pelt and Opie Library, I believe, in 2004.
As the senior archivist, what does that entail for you?
As the senior archivist, I wear many hats within the library. I oversee the daily operations of the reading room, so I supervise our reference associate and work with her as she's helping customers conduct their research and figure out which collections will be useful to them. I also oversee some student assistants who help with all sorts of special projects, and I collaborate with our duplication specialist if people want to create or get a print of something that we have in our photograph collection, she'll work with them. Or if there's any kind of records that they need duplicated, we'll work with her on that. I also collaborate with all my colleagues within the library. I sit on several committees to talk about what's happening within the library and how we can increase efficiencies between departments and how we can basically make the best experience for people that come in and do research within the archives and the Van Pelt and Opie Library generally.
The archives, I think it was about a year ago, received the it was designated as a Keweenaw Heritage Site. First off, tell people what that designation means and what it takes for a place to get that kind of designation.
Sure. I actually wasn't at Michigan Tech when they were filing the application to become a heritage site, so I don't have a lot of background on that actual process. But I do know that the Keweenaw Heritage Sites, it's a network of local cultural and heritage institutions, so museums, archives, historical societies, things of this nature. It's a partnership with this network with the National Park Service. So the Keweenaw National Historical Park helps coordinate this network of different sites throughout the region to help interpret the mining history of the region. So it has that strong mining focus, looking on, you know, the heritage of the Copper Country and, you know, how the the industry changed the landscape and, you know, how we live and how we work and things like that. So
this past week, you gave me a nice tour of the archives, and I was blown away by how much stuff is there, and just blown away of how it was organized. What was that process like to have everything in its specific place?
Well, the nature of archives, we preserve things and we need to be able to make them accessible. So we have to have very stringent standards in terms of how we organize our collections. And this starts right from the initial phase when someone comes in to donate a collection. And it goes through a whole series of events before it can get to that place on the shelf where it's going to have its designated home. We go through the appraisal process as we're taking in a collection just to see what we have, if it has any preservation concerns, trying to understand and gain intellectual control of what's being donated. After that phase, we go ahead and we begin processing, which is arrangement and description of the collection. So we're really physically handling the documents, reading letters, looking at photographs, figuring out what's there and how we can put it back into some sort of original order so it makes sense as a collection. After that phase, we go through cataloging, which is what I do as a senior archivist. I'm the sole cataloger for manuscript collections within the archives right now, although I do collaborate with my colleagues in resource access and discovery services quite a bit, just figuring out the appropriate way to describe things because it is a complex process. Once we have it cataloged, it is then discoverable through our online catalogs, and we also put it into something called WorldCat, which is an internationally searched database that if you type in a search query, you can find, it'll link back to our finding aids at Michigan Tech and let you know what we have. And then it has a place on the shelf to live, and we can help you access it.
It seems like it's a very, very long process. How many people are we talking about involved in that?
I would say almost the entire library, because it's a total coordinated effort. I mean, you're working with donors, and sometimes that includes gifts of monetary value, actual, you know, cash donations or gifts in kind, such as books, collections, papers, things like that. And to figure out what we can and cannot take, we have to establish policy, and that involves a lot of people within the library to dictate those policies in terms of what we can accept and what our collection scope should be and things like that.
Is there, I mean, I don't mean for you to put like a percentage on it, but how often does stuff get turned away? Like just saying maybe this isn't something that we want in the collection.
I would say occasionally, if maybe very rarely. Since I've been there, I've accepted, I want to say, at least 20 to 25 collections just in the few months that I've been here this year. And I've flat out not accepted something. And then there was a few times where I felt that it wasn't an appropriate fit for what we collect, but I thought perhaps another local institution could benefit from it. There was an example of someone that wanted to donate some clothing to the archives, but we don't really have a lot of space to maintain textile collections. So we thought maybe one of the local museums or historical societies could benefit from something like that, since they do exhibits and it's nice to have those visually interesting things on display. So I'm not sure what that donor did, but we will try to give them somewhere to go to if they're, you know, bent on donating something. So we wanted to find a home.
In terms of the time frame of the process, is it basically it's different for each piece that comes in? Like, what would be an average time frame getting it from right when it comes into your office to hitting the shelf on average?
It's really hard to speak in terms of averages like that, because it really depends on what's coming in the door. I can give an example of a small photo collection of less than 20 photographs, and something like that, technically in terms of physical work time, I mean, it would only take a few days to process something like that and get it fully described. But we do have collections that range, you know, upwards of several hundred boxes, close to 1,000 boxes. So you can only imagine the amount of effort that goes into arranging everything on a folder level or an item level so you know what's there. I mean, it can take years sometimes, and it's an ongoing process. Things evolve. We recently completed an NHPRC grant, and Dan and Rachel, they were two project archivists that came and worked with us, and they were able to highlight 92 collections that were previously undiscoverable, and it took them on that project about 2 years to go through those 92 different collections. So,
you're listening to Copper Country Today, here with my guest, Lindsay Hiltonen from the Michigan Tech Archives. Let's get right into all the different kinds of stuff that you guys have. I remember you showed me the government documents, and it's you got stuff from Gogebic County, Keweenaw County. What kind of stuff are in those books?
Sure. We are, through the state of Michigan, the Michigan Archives, we have a depository agreement with them to collect non-current public records for this region. And so some examples of that, you know, there's tax rolls, there's birth and marriage announcements. Sometimes you'll find immigration and naturalization papers. And the example that I showed you when we gave the tour, I had pulled out the index to search the Gogebic County naturalization records. And, you know, you're able to go and see when a relative filed first or second papers, if they did so in this region. It can be difficult to track that sometimes, though, because you know that a relative lived in this area, it doesn't necessarily mean that they filed for citizenship here.
Mm-hmm.
So tracking down those papers can be a complex task, and sometimes you're looking for a needle in a haystack. But you always, you know, try to satisfy the research request. We want people to walk out happy, but sometimes we simply don't have the documents.
I mean, I think you hit on it earlier. The mining history, it's huge in this area, and there's so much of it in so many different kinds of forms at the archives.
Sure. Yeah, we do collect a lot of things related to the cultural, industrial, and social history of the Copper Country. I would say roughly 80% of our manuscript collections relate to that type of collection focus. And of those types of records, the corporate records from the major mining companies are significant collections in that, under the umbrella of that. We have the Calumet and Hecla records, we have Quincy Mining Company records, and we also have the historic Copper Range Company records. And within those, you'll find all types of documentation. We'll have internal correspondence, we'll have different lease agreements for company property. You can track down employment cards for people that worked in the mines. And I like to highlight those employment cards because it's not just useful for people researching mining history, but it's also useful for people researching family history in terms of genealogy. You can get a lot of rich contextual information off of those cards. We have people come in and they're so thrilled to find original signatures and know what their great-great-grandpa made in the mines. And sometimes on the back it'll say, you know, what country they came from, if they spoke and wrote in English or not, if they were married, if they had children, where they lived, all kinds of great information to help you track down family history. So
another big one that it's kind of similar to finding out the mining history were the maps. And it seems like you just look at it and the roads are still there and everything. Maybe not the houses and the structure of the houses, but everything just seems to be so accurate.
Sure. I think it's interesting to note accurate for the time that it was made. It's nice to look back at some of these historic maps to see how they evolved over time, as things were updated, as towns evolved, or as deindustrialization came in, how they shrank, how they changed. But yeah, we do have a significant map collection, not just of street type maps or those Sanborn insurance maps that I showed you yesterday. We also have quite a few blueprints and architectural drawings from some of the mining companies. We have a lot of geologic maps, topography, all kinds of different things. So,
and the photos that really caught my eye. I saw one of downtown Houghton, and it just everything it's still there, and you still got some of the signs, some old businesses, and everything. In terms of what kind of people come to see the photos?
I would say that our photo collections are a really popular type of collection, not just with our prints, but we also have significant negative collections that we can then create prints for customers. But I would say most people that come in the door at some point, they notice either our photo exhibit on the wall or they're interested to do some research into our photo files. I think it's interesting that you highlight the Houghton photo that you saw, because those street scenes, the historic street scenes, yeah. I would say that's one of the most popular types of photos, because people just ooh and ah. They remember what it was like when they were children, exactly. Or they remember what it was like when they traveled here. You know, maybe they lived away and moved back, and just seeing how the town has changed over time, different businesses that came through, or those that stood the test of time, and just to see how they changed. I think that's really interesting, not just in terms of architecture or business, but just, you know, for how we live our lives and go about our day to day.
And is it safe to assume that another popular one is the newspaper clippings?
Sure. Newspaper vertical files, as well as our newspapers on microfilm, they get used on a daily basis. A lot of times people will come in, they're looking for an obituary of a loved one, and mm-hmm. we're able to, you know, direct them to that if they have the name and the date that, you know, that the death occurred. And, you know, it's important to preserve that type of information. There's also a lot of rich history just in terms of the historic headlines looking back. You can go to significant events in Copper Country history, and we have over 70 different newspapers that are on microfilm from the region. So just seeing how different papers reported the same event, seeing how perspectives changed, you know, depending on, you know, where you were writing from or who your audience was. So,
and you showed me the collection of the audio clips from an older radio station that was here. How did you guys end up obtaining those?
I'm not sure of the donor history of those, of that collection, but I do know that it's one that we have our sights on. We have some historic tapes from WGGL, and I think they're very interesting, not just, you know, from the Michigan Tech mm-hmm. University perspective, but also the community perspective, because there's all sorts of great radio programming, different performance artists that came. One of my personal favorites, and I know the interim department head, Chad Arney, also enjoys this. So there's a Muddy Waters tape in there. He came to Michigan Tech, I believe, in the 1970s, and just to get that digitized and online mm-hmm. would be amazing.
You're listening to Copper Country Today, here with my guest, Lindsay Hiltonen from the Michigan Tech Archives. I do want to hit briefly on the fire incident that happened.
Sure.
What exactly caused the damage?
Yeah, back in October of 2012, there was an incident, they believe, with one of the UV shields on the light, and it sparked a small fire that set off a zoned sprinkler release within the archives. And I believe that was October 26, 2012.
And the damage, as you told me, wasn't in terms of the grand scheme of things, wasn't really that much?
Yeah, I mean, in this sense, I would, number one, like to stress the amazing response, not just within the archives, but the library as a whole, the social science department at Michigan Tech, and other volunteers from the campus community, as well as the community at large, and different agencies that helped us. But we were able to have a very quick recovery in terms of, or quick response, should I say, and less than 0.5% of items were damaged, were a total loss. So we almost had 100% recovery.
And in terms of the response from the community, how did people react? They must have been really, you know, concerned.
There was a pretty big outpouring of support, not just in terms of, you know, well wishes and hoping that we could get through it, but people that actually came and volunteered their time. I have an interesting example. My current colleague, Erin, she actually helped orchestrate some of that event, but the way that she got involved with the response was she emailed Eric Nordberg, who was the university archivist at the time, and asked how she could help, and it mm-hmm. turned into her having a position helping coordinate some of those efforts in terms of refoldering and getting things into clean housing and back into their proper order. So,
going back to community involvement, what's the process like of the donation the donation process? Like, how much, if you could put a percentage, how much of the archives is donated?
I would say nearly 100%, and especially in terms of manuscript collections, almost everything was a donation, either within the university community or the local community. Even donors that from the national community, we have people that, you know, like to travel here, and they either grew up or they have a connection to this place, so they have materials that relate. So we have donors that span all across this place, and it's interesting because we do occasionally purchase books for the collection, but we very rarely purchase any kind of archival material itself, usually only published monographs. So,
and for people who come, and you mentioned earlier about people who come to research, you know, family history and stuff like that, when they reach that aha moment, what is their reaction when they get to see the lineage of their family dating back to decades before?
Well, I mean, it varies by person, but it's almost typically, you know, just an amazingly an emotional response, because it's an amazing moment when you can put that piece together, when you've been searching for that one link for so long, and then you find that one piece of information that connects the chain together. You know, I've seen people tear up when they see original signatures of family members. I've mm-hmm. seen people shout Eureka. I've witnessed people jumping up and down, you know, any kind of range of just pure joy, you know, to find what you've been looking for.
For those who do want to come in and do any kind of research, what kind of steps do they need to go through?
Well, we have a fairly open door policy. We believe in walk-in research, so you can come and visit us during our regular business hours, Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. You can also reach out to the archives by calling 906-487-2505 or emailing us at copper@mtu.edu, and we'd be happy to talk to you about how to get your research started and to let you know if we have collections that might help you.
In terms of what you would like to see in the future of the archives, are there any plans, anything that you would like to see going forward that you'd like to see added to the archives?
Well, I think we would like to get to a place where almost all of our collections are discoverable online. Mm-hmm. As an archivist, one tool that we create to help people navigate a collection is a finding aid, and it's critical to get all those finding aids published online so they can be harvested by search engines, so people that are researching can come to Michigan Tech, see our website, see this collection that we have, and have a sense of what's in it without physically holding the collection in their hands. So that's definitely one thing that's an effort that I'm going to continue to do and work with my colleagues to get that accomplished. Another thing I would like to see is just continuing our programming. We do a lot of interesting speaker series, and we have a travel grant program where thanks to the Friends of the Van Pelt Library, they fund a program for us to give money to researchers to come and use our collections. Mm-hmm. And part of that agreement, then, they conduct a public talk or a lecture about a local topic. And I would like to see that continue into the future. And I just recently got the funding for the 2015 cycle. So thanks to the Friends, and thanks to my colleagues that helped me write that proposal.
You might have a little bit of a biased answer to this question, but why do you think it's important to have an archive for this community?
I think it's important on so many different levels. Just from the community identity aspect, I think it's important that we preserve the past, we make it accessible, and having original documents at hand to talk about what this place was, how it was shaped, how it became what it is, that's totally important to understanding our past, our present, and where we can go in the future. I like this idea of fostering collective memory. There's all types of different stories in the Copper Country, all types of different narratives, mm-hmm. people from different walks of life, people that immigrated and had different backgrounds, and I think preserving all those stories so we can understand that our history is complex and our history is quite special and unique, and to me that the archives helps in that mission to, you know, remember the past and conceptualize it.
And even for those for people who are not big into researching, or they just want to get a tour. Those are available as well?
Sure. Yep. As a newly minted Kuna Heritage Site, we thought it would be appropriate to have some sort of public engagement, and we thought a tour would be the best fit for us. If you'd like to schedule a tour, you can, you know, contact us at copper@mtu.edu to talk about how to set that up. Our typical touring times are Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., so there's a two-hour window, and we try to keep the tour around 25 to 30 minutes. It's open to the public. It's free. There's no charge. You can get a passport stamp on the Kuna Heritage Site passport program.
Excellent.
And then you can just come and see what we have. We try to limit tours to less than 10 people, simply because of the delicate nature of the collections that we're working with. Mm-hmm. We like to try to have a hands-on experience, so I will pass out employment cards. My colleague Sawyer Newman gives an amazing tour. She's a seasoned professional at it, and she likes to have that hands-on element as well. So,
alrighty, well, that'll wrap up this segment of Copper Country Today. Lindsay Hiltonen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks. This was fun.
Our program is brought to you in part by the members of the Copper Country Education Association and by the Copper Country Veterinary Clinic, proud supporters of the Copper Country Humane Society and the Kiwanis Spay and Neuter Assistance Group. You can also listen to a podcast of our program by going to the Copper Country Today page at qnrreport.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Copper Country Today.